Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, Reengaging China on Human Rights with John Kam, the founder and executive director of the Dui Hua Foundation. Although President Trump has discussed many issues related to U.S.-China relations, he has remained largely silent on human rights. John Kam's Dui Hua Foundation has been conducting an unofficial dialogue with the Chinese government and judiciary since 1999. This dialogue focuses on the treatment of prisoners, juvenile justice, women in prison, and the death penalty, all topics that could be covered if official dialogue is revitalized. A New York Times Magazine article introduced John Kam as follows. Almost no one seemed less likely to become a crusader for human rights than John Kam. He was the president of Hong Kong's American Chamber of Commerce and a regional vice president of Occidental Chemical Corporation, a multinational company that, in addition to paying Kam very handsomely, provided him with a luxury apartment, a Mercedes and driver, two maids, a cost of living allowance, private school tuition for his sons, and paid home leave. But he left it all behind to take up the cause of prisoners' rights in China. He estimates that his involvement has been at least partly responsible for about 250 prisoners being released or being given better treatment in prison. In the words of the New York Times, no other person or organization in the world, including the State Department, has helped more Chinese prisoners. He was in the New York Times again just this last Sunday when they reported the release of Sandy Fan Gillis, an American businesswoman arrested for the supposed theft of state secrets while she was on a trade mission from Texas. At the request of her husband, John Kam raised her case more than two dozen times with Chinese officials. And John can tell us more about this case today, as well as reengaging with China on human rights. I'd like to note that John does hold a record for our forum by having this be the sixth time that he's addressed our group here at the Commonwealth Club. Would you please welcome John Kam?
Well, thank you very much, Cynthia, and thank you all for coming. Oh, yes, I do need to do that. You know, when Abraham Lincoln debated Frederick Douglass, there were no microphones in those days. So they had to speak without a microphone. But here I am with a microphone. If I wander, I will not take the microphone with me. Again, thank you, Cynthia. It's a pleasure to be here again. It is indeed the sixth time I have addressed a group here at the Commonwealth Club, going back quite a few years, actually. I moved to San Francisco. Well, I bought my apartment in San Francisco in 1991, I confess, and it was a great price. But I didn't move here until 1995 from Hong Kong. And here I am, the Dui Hua Foundation. My colleagues are in the audience tonight. Thank you, all of you, for coming. Why don't my colleagues stand up, please? Thank you very much. Cynthia has mentioned a very important case, and I'd like to start by talking a bit about it. Sandy Fan Gillis is an American businesswoman of ethnic Chinese descent, a very distinguished Chinese-American, by the way. She worked for three decades to promote good U.S.-China relations. 3 decades. She came to this country as an overseas Chinese from Vietnam, one of the boat people. She escaped by boat to Malaysia, where she eventually was resettled to the United States. She came over as a teenager. She worked hard. She became a U.S. citizen. She started in the restaurant business, built restaurants. But at some point, she decided that she would do more and decided she would promote relations between the United States and China. And she did so. Among other things she did, she introduced a gentleman by the name of Yao Ming to the Houston Rockets. And she was president of the... Thank you. She was president of the Houston Sunjun Sister City Association for several years. That particular association is one of the biggest sister city associations in the United States. Yeah? So I say all that because I want you to understand that in addition to being an American citizen, she is a distinguished citizen who sought to improve relations between the two countries. On March 19th, 2015, Ms. Van Gillis was accompanying a delegation, a trade delegation, to China, led by the mayor pro tem of Houston. They all exited the country, but she did not. She was taken into custody by the state security police at the border with Macau. She was then taken to Nanning in Guangxi, where she was placed under residential surveillance in a designated location. Now, this is a particularly noxious coercive measure. Some of you may be familiar with it because it is used against Chinese dissidents and activists. In this case, it was used against an American citizen. It can be used against you. No reason why it cannot. So anyway, she spent 6 months in residential surveillance in a designated location. When it ended, she was formally detained and put into a detention center, a state security detention center. On that evening, the husband called me. I was in Hong Kong. The next day, I was flying to Beijing. That was 19 months ago. I raised it immediately and consistently with the Chinese government over the last 19 months. Cut to the present. She was convicted on Monday, April 25th, by the Anning Intermediate People's Court of espionage on behalf of the U.S. government. She was sentenced to 3.5 years and deportation. And deportation. Not followed by deportation. On Friday, she was deported. She is back. She is with her family. Now, if you take nothing away from this evening, I want you to register this. There are two types of deportation in China as a foreigner. There is followed by deportation, and there is and deportation. Followed by deportation goes like this. Let's say you are sentenced to 10 years in prison. Followed by deportation. What that means is you serve all 10 years, and then you are deported. Then there is deportation as a standalone penalty. The sentence and deportation. That means that you can be deported immediately without serving the sentence. So, if ever you find yourself in trouble in China in a criminal case, you must tell your lawyer, I want the standalone deportation. All right? Is that clear? You can all go home now. No, I'm serious. This is very important. A lot of times the court says, deportation is deportation, standalone, supplemental, whatever. Make sure, is deportation as a standalone penalty. Okay? So I look forward to answering some of your questions on this very important case. It is a rare victory in the struggle for human rights in China. And I think, very importantly, it involves an American citizen. All right? You got to start somewhere. If you can't help American citizens, who can you help? But if you can help American citizens, you can help American, as I like to put it to my Chinese government friends, you can help prisoners with an American flavor. There are prisoners in China who have spouses and relatives living in this country. I hope we can help them too. And I'm working on it. It's very difficult. There's a man, an American citizen. Name is James Wong. This gentleman was living in Hong Kong. He's a full American citizen living in Hong Kong. He runs a little publishing operation that publishes various articles and publications that are critical of the Chinese government in Hong Kong. This is not one of the bookseller cases, by the way. This is a separate case, American citizen. But he made a mistake. He traveled to China on his Hong Kong documents. He did not use his U.S. passport. Now, that's my second little recommendation for this evening. American passport holder, and you are traveling to China, and you are tempted to use your Hong Kong documents. Why? It's easy. You don't have to pay a visa fee. You just show up at the border. Whatever you do, if you think there is even the slightest chance that the police in China are looking for you, never use your Hong Kong documents. This gentleman is now in a Chinese prison, and he has no protection from the U.S. government. It's my second recommendation. I'm very practical these days. First recommendation, deportation as a standalone penalty. Make sure your lawyer gets that into his or her head. Secondly, all right, use your U.S. passport at all times. Number two. Now, I'm not going to spend a long time, but I do want to speak a little bit about the topic that I have drawn you all to attend, re-engaging China on human rights. After Tiananmen, the Chinese government adopted a policy of engaging countries in bilateral dialogues on human rights. That began roughly in 1991. Over the next few years, official dialogues were instituted with about 9 countries, and then we had consultations. Now, the big ones were the U.S., the EU, and to some extent Switzerland. 9. Last year, there were 3. So as time has gone by, the number of bilateral dialogues has decreased. So starting in 1991, we had a number of these official dialogues. Now we're down to 3. Meanwhile, yours truly began engaging the Chinese government in what we call an unofficial dialogue on human rights. And that is ongoing. I just came back from a trip. I think we've managed to achieve a few things. I do take a very different approach. I think the Sandy Van Gillis case is an important achievement. We've done some other things. One of the things I've tried to do is to find ways to engage the Chinese government in issues where they feel, where they are open to engagement. Right? Like juvenile justice. It's so important. And we've just reached agreement with the Chinese Supreme Court to do another exchange on juvenile justice. This is something they are open to. And so am I. I think all of us should be. And I don't see a contradiction between our work on behalf of political prisoners and juveniles. You know, there are a lot of juvenile political prisoners, especially in Tibet and Xinjiang. There are a lot of them. So when I work on juvenile justice, I don't see a contradiction between our work for political prisoners and juveniles. Okay? So this is an area where we can cooperate. You have this newsletter sitting over there. If you look at that picture, you will see a caption in which I am meeting with a senior Chinese official at which we discussed cooperation on human rights. Imagine that. Can we cooperate with China on human rights? Well, in some areas we can. Other areas, no. But in the area of juvenile justice, we can cooperate. There's another area we can cooperate. Capital punishment. The United States and China are 2 of the only major countries still executing people, practicing capital punishment. I think we should sit down and talk to each other about this. The trend is towards reducing the number of executions. By talking about that, I think we can accelerate the reduction in the number of executions. On my last trip to Beijing not even a month ago, I got information that allowed me to estimate the number of executions that took place in China last year, which has been published. 2,000 people were executed last year. The number is coming down, just as the number is coming down in this country. We can work together on this. We should, I hope, someday do away with capital punishment. What purpose does it serve? What purpose does it serve? And I think that by working together, we can do something in this area. So we can cooperate. We can't cooperate in every area. I don't think that the two countries can have a useful dialogue on ethnic issues, either in this country or in China. In my opinion, doesn't mean we should stop trying, but I don't see much prospect for that. So, I've been speaking for 25 minutes. I would like to open the floor for questions. Thank you again for joining us tonight.
Thank you for what you have done in the past and what you are going to do in the future. About U.S. citizen, I went back to China as a U.S. citizen in 2014 on the 25th anniversary of Tiananmen massacre. And I was sent back the next day after the arrest me. But now I knew before I went there, I studied the cases of foreign citizens in Chinese prison housing. In particular, the recent arrests of kidnapping of the booksellers who are mostly foreign citizens. Have this... I think someone from the Ministry of Public Security or the foreign minister said that if you are Chinese, if you're born in China, you have to get a permission to leave Chinese citizenship. So you cannot just, if you get a U.S. passport, became naturalized U.S. citizen, that doesn't count. I think that's the official reason they give now to all these cases of foreign citizens born in China. You have any comments on that?
Well, first of all, thank you. And by the way, this gentleman was one of the great heroes of Tiananmen Square. And so, it's the first time we have met.
And he remembered me.
Well, first of all, I don't know what goes on in their minds. I really don't. I mean, my understanding is, if you renounce your Chinese citizenship and take on foreign citizenship, you are a foreign citizen. That's my understanding. In the Sandy Fangillis case, this has never arisen as a question. All right, she is acknowledged to be a U.S. citizen. In some of these other cases, as in the Guiman Hai case, okay, Guiman Hai is a Swedish citizen. Yeah? Now, he has not been actually classified as a Chinese citizen by the Chinese government. But what has happened is that he has tried to renounce his Swedish citizenship while he is in detention. To its credit, the Swedish government hasn't gone along with that. Basically, this is a two-party agreement. you take on citizenship, we grant it. You just don't get to say, I don't want it anymore. We have granted it. So I hope that other countries will follow that model, actually. This is an agreement between us and you. You know, you've been our citizen with all the benefits that have accrued, and now you are in a detention center telling us that you want to renounce it. Well, I'm sorry. That's not the way it goes. So, yes, you're right. I think with Canada, it's a special issue, isn't it? That with Canadians, there's some question as to whether or not you actually do become a foreign citizen if you renounce your Chinese citizenship. I'm really not an expert in these matters, but in my opinion, if in fact, and that's, by the way, why it's so important to get the court documents in every case, because the court documents state whether or not you are a foreign citizen. And it's more and more difficult to get those court documents. To date, we have neither the indictment or the judgment in the Fenn Gillis case. We don't know. I don't know if that's much of an answer to Joe, but that's the way it is.
I was just wondering, because you are white, whether the Chinese government gives you more credence. I would imagine if somebody from Hong Kong or Taiwan who was Chinese wanted to fight the government and promote human rights and all that, would have a much more difficult time.
Mm.
But, you know, I taught for a year in China, and it's really funny the way the government treats overseas Chinese. On the one hand, they welcome you back to the so-called motherland, but on the other hand, they make a point of letting you know that you're a foreigner. And by that, I mean, when I was given my ID card from the university where I was teaching, I had a Chinese name, but they didn't use my Chinese name. They purposely would say Fu Lan Ke for Frank, and then my last name. Mm. They kept the last name. But it, obviously, it's a way of letting people know you're a foreigner. You're not one of us. So anyway, I'm wondering if race has a lot to do with your ability to gain access to the Chinese authorities, because somebody Chinese might not simply because he looks Chinese.
Yeah, that's a good question, a difficult one to answer. Bear in mind, of course, that Cynthia mentioned that we set up Doi Hua in 1999. Actually, the very first intervention I made on behalf of a prisoner was in 1990, 27 years ago. At the time, I was the president of the Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong. I think the reason they continue to see me and deal with me and talk to me has more to do with the history. In other words, if I were an overseas American Chinese in 1990 who did that, who actually confronted a Chinese official on behalf of a prisoner at a banquet, if I had done that, I don't think today it would make much difference if I was white or African-American or whatever. I mean, I did it, and I have continued doing it for 27 years. Now, to your point, to your question, if I am Pei, who is turning 100, I understand, were to have taken the lead on intervening on behalf of prisoners, I rather suspect he would still be given a welcome and people would hear him out. So it's not just a question of race, although I have to say, if you're an American business executive and now you have the China portfolio and now you go into China and you want to raise the name of a political prisoner, good luck. They're not going to listen to you, all right? And they're going to, like, see you right away as you know, somebody who's playing some kind of a game.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So race does play a role, but it's not necessarily the determining factor. History is. You have to have a history for caring about people in China. Otherwise, they're not going to listen to you. In my case, they still see me. I go every year several times. I meet with Chinese officials elsewhere, in this country, in Europe. We get a few things done. I don't think it has to do so much with race as history, in my opinion. But race, of course, I agree. If you're an overseas Chinese and you go into China and sort of raise cases, you're not going to get a welcome, okay? So, yes, sir.
Perhaps it's early days, but I wonder what your thoughts are as far as the new government in this country will have on Chinese-American relations.
Mm. Well, I have a lot of thoughts, but they change every day. All right, well, okay. Mr. Trump has made it very clear, both during the campaign and up to the present day, that from now on, it's putting America first, right? He said that repeatedly. Well, you know, it's a short step from putting America first to putting Americans first. So, about 2 weeks ago, a little bit more, an Egyptian woman, Egyptian-American, her release was secured. And she was flown back to the United States after 3 years in detention. Okay? Why? Because Mr. Trump, putting Americans first, intervened on her behalf with this fellow President Sisi. She's home. She's back. All right? The previous administration couldn't do that. He did it. Okay. Now we have Sandy Fangillis back. He directed Tillerson to go to Beijing and get her out. He did. So, what am I to make of this? Putting Americans first. Is this a bad thing? Well, it's a bad thing if it means putting others last. Yes. But it might be a good thing if we can push the boundaries a bit, if we can include prisoners who have an American connection. Let's do that. Let's do that. And there are plenty. There is Dunde Pwangshan, whose wife is here in the Bay Area with 4 children, living in the Bay Area. I call her a prisoner with an American flavor, Dunde Pwangshan. We have James Wong, an American citizen I was just talking about. He is an American citizen, but because he didn't travel on his passport, he is something less than an American citizen. There's Jiang Tianyong, one of the lawyers. His wife lives in Texas. And so on. So let's push out the boundaries. I think Mr. Trump might be open to that. I hope so. We need runs on the board. We need successes. We need to get people out. And if it means putting American first, I'll play that game. But I need more than Sandy Fangillis. This gentleman.
What do you think about the idea that President Trump's bravado appeals to some foreign countries? And we have not had that kind of bravado for a long time, and we have given away a lot. And could they be relating to his bravado, and they want to respect America, but America, some countries do America better than America does America, and some countries still maybe want to strive to hit the American dynamic, but they don't see an avenue to do that. But a boisterous bravado president maybe is setting a precedent that they have long missed. Comment on that.
Well, that's a very good question and a very good comment. He's a transactional fellow. So are the Chinese. I mean, one day he's saying this, the next day he's saying it would be an honor to meet Kim Jong-un. I mean, you know, whoa. So he's definitely keeping people off balance. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm a transactional kind of guy. I wake up every morning, look at the news, look at my inbox, and think, okay, what can I do today for this president, this prisoner, or that prisoner? But a lot depends on the environment. You know, you have to, in these situations, you have to fight from fluid positions. And he's very good at that. And so I'm not, you know what I think, actually? Something that does disturb me a little bit. You know, there's so many people who hate Donald Trump so much that they cannot admit of the possibility that this man can actually do some good things. I didn't vote for him, but I'll be damned if I am going to stop my work on behalf of prisoners because I don't like Donald Trump. On the contrary, I'm going to try to use him. I'm using him. He's not using me. That's being transactional. That's being transactional. You need to use him more than he is going to use you. And if I can ride him into a better day when we are gaining the release of political prisoners in China, in Chinese prisons, I'm happy to do it. I've been doing it for 27 years. That's a lot of presidents. And every time somebody gets out, I credit them. I credit them. I say, thank you very much. Brilliant. Thank you so much. That's what I do. I don't question them. I praise them. That's my answer. Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Kam. Thank you for all the work that you've done.
Oh, thank you, Scarlett.
Okay, so my question is that the Chinese government enacted a new law on the management of foreign NGOs.
Yes.
In the beginning of this year. So how has that and how will that impact your work in China?
Ah, great question. All right. So as Scarlett has just asked, effective January 1st, a new foreign NGO law has been enacted. It is in force. Now, the law requires foreign NGOs that have a presence in China to register. Now, last year, it was estimated that there were 6,000 foreign NGOs operating in China. So far, 62 have registered, which means that there are a whole lot of NGOs out there that have not been able to register, and technically speaking, they are operating illegally in China. And so some of them have left. The American Bar Association
has closed its office and left China. Oh, yeah. Now, there's another kind of NGO. These are NGOs that do not have a presence in China, but who conduct activities in China under so-called temporary activities permit. That's what we do. I tell you what, I've been doing business in China for more than 40 years. I have never established an office in Beijing, ever. And it's something I wouldn't do. But I do a lot of work in China as temporary activities. So I'm very happy to tell you that we have reached an agreement with the Supreme People's Court to conduct a program on juvenile justice in November under the new law. I think we're the only ones who've done that so far. So, you know, some of you in the audience understand Chinese, others don't. But in Chinese, there's a saying, Ni yo zheng zi, wo yo tui zi. You have your policy, I have the way around it. That's what's going on. For every policy that they put out, we can find a way around it. You know, internet controls, we can find a way around it. It's tough, yeah, but we can do it. And on the NGO law, yes, it's creating great difficulties for NGOs. Increasing difficulties. Why? We're in May. NGOs have budgets. They have grants. They have to spend the money. If you don't spend it, you lose it. So NGOs that have budgets to do work in China and they're not registered, they can't spend the money. They're pulling out and they're putting money elsewhere. So the impact of this law will be very, very serious going forward. For us, we have found a way around it. But I think for most people, most NGOs, no, they can't. So it's quite a blow. Yes. Yes.
Yes, I was wondering what your take is on why Sandy Vangelis was arrested in the first place. I know you haven't seen the court documents, but you must have an idea of why she was arrested.
I wish I could answer that. I mean, you know, no one has seen the indictment other than the lawyer who apparently read it to the husband. So you've got the court, the lawyer, the husband. So fourth hand, that's the indictment. No one has seen the judgment. Do I have speculations? Yes, I do. She apparently was accused of spying for the FBI. I think those of you who know anything about the FBI knows that it's an internal organization. It doesn't conduct espionage overseas. On the other hand, the FBI has arrested a lot of Chinese in this country. So is that in play? I don't know, maybe. But it is a curious case. How can someone who has, I mean, you know, others beside myself have said she is the poster child for good U.S.-China relations. I mean, you look at what she has done over the years, the delegation she has sent and received, the assistance she has rendered. It's just amazing. And if she can be treated like this, who amongst you are safe? Who do you think are safe? No one is safe. So it's a very significant case. And I it's not over. But she's home. We don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, continuing on this transactional theme. So what's in it for the Chinese to release prisoners, not American prisoners, but What do you convince them that they'll get out of it?
Mm. Well, okay. A couple of years ago, I made a speech in Washington, and you can find it. It was on the Center for whatever, anyway, you'll find it on my website. And I looked at this question, all right? Why does the Chinese government make human rights concessions? Because, you know, at the time, they weren't. They had just stopped. And the reason was, they said, well, what's in it for us? You know, we're big, we're strong, we got all the money. You know, what do we need to make concessions for? And I said at the time, when the time comes, when they need to make a concession, they will. So just remember that. With respect to Sandy Finkels, I'll tell you what. She was in mid-flight when Secretary Tillerson met with the Foreign Minister Wang Yi in New York last Friday, a very important meeting having to do with North Korea. And the Chinese side very much wanted to devote that time to North Korea. All right? They did not want to spend 15 minutes arguing about Sandy Fangillis. All right? Makes sense? Right? So they let her go. It was in their interest to do so. So that's the point. Years ago, when we had that big debate over most favored nation, right? And in the end, the Clinton administration said, okay, you have MFN without conditions, 1993, almost a quarter century ago. And so I went to see a senator who had voted consistently to take away China's trade status. But when Clinton became president, he changed his position and supported President Clinton's decision to renew most favored nation without conditions. So I went to him and I said, look, Senator, don't get me wrong. You know, I was a businessman and president of the chamber and everything. Don't get me wrong. I'm not criticizing you, but how do you explain that? Last year, you voted to take away China's most favored nation. Now you're voting to keep it. What's changed? Why did you do that? And here's what he said. Well, John, we've gotten as much as we can get by using most favored nation. But I'm not concerned. You know why? China is a developing country. They will always want something. The trick is finding out what they want and how much they are prepared to pay for it. That has guided me for the last 25 years. Find out what they want and how much they are willing to pay for it. Okay? And I tell you, in the coming days, I expect to have one or two more victories like Sandy Fangillis, because I know what they want. And I think I know what they want to pay for it to get it. That's the key. That's transactional. That's transactional. And that's Donald Trump. All right?
I was thinking about the ones who don't have an American connection, though.
Yeah.
The ones you dig up and...
Well, all I can say is this. You know, I had one of my able staff put together a list. We have... last year, we submitted... Forgive me. I have to look at the numbers. So last year, we submitted 26 prisoner lists. There were 249 names on those lists. we got responses, written responses on 54 cases. You know how many responses everyone else in the world got? Zero. Governments, UN, zero. We got 54. How many people on our lists received clemency? 69. How many received better treatment in prison? 8. Well, this year we've submitted 9 lists so far. First quarter, 78 names, responses on 36 prisoners. 7 acts of clemency. And these acts of clemency are important. I mean, lives have been saved. So, what about, I still put their names on lists, they still take my lists, and there's a high percentage of people on my lists who benefit. That's all I can say.
I believe I have the mic.
You do.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you very much from the bottom of my heart and from the bottom of, I believe, the hearts of many Tibetan and Chinese people who are my friends, for your work fighting for human rights and for genuine dialogue between America and China and others. My question, of course, as a friend of Tibet and China, is issues relating to them. Mm-hmm. So I want to know, first of all, what you might think if you were in the room with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. As you know, there's been no negotiations whatsoever, like formally since like the 19, for like 12 or 13 years. And what would you advise the Dalai Lama? And second of all, the most highest profile political prisoner of the Tibetan people is the Panchen Lama, the second most revered Lama of Tibet, believed to be the reincarnation of the Buddha of love and light. We all deserve salvation. And so I'm wondering what you can do to help us get us closer to finding the missing Panchen Lama and what you would advise the Dalai Lama in these interesting times.
You know, recently I have been writing, before it's too late, what I remember about the cases I've worked on. And if you go to my website, you will find a couple of stories in there. Under a series called John Cam Remembers. And the first one was in January. It told the story of the effort to secure the release of Jigme Tsongpo. Please have a look. And then you can look at our March issue, which tells the story of the Dropchi nuns, the singing nuns of Dropchi. All right? Milan Kundera once famously wrote that the struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. And so we shouldn't forget. We shouldn't forget the successes and instead only dwell on what we have yet to achieve. I happen to know that the Dalai Lama, His Holiness, has read those stories and has been inspired. What can we do? I wish I knew. But what I can tell you is this. I meet with the Chinese government frequently, here, elsewhere, in China, in Hong Kong. And, you know, you just got to be open. You have to be prepared for them to say something that you don't expect. And I tell you this, someday I will hear something about the Panchen Lama. Very unexpected. It will happen.
You just have to keep your ears open and your mind open to the possibility of mercy. That's the main thing. Do I have a formula for helping him get out? No. I just keep my ears open and my mind open. There will come a day. There will come a day. I'm sure of it.
Thank you, John. So I just need to want to ask a follow-up question. About the John Kam Remember series. I read the stories, and it was it was very enriching to read your account. But at the same time, I was also trying to this thought shot up in my mind, which was like, well, Jigme Sangpo and all this release happened about over a decade.
More than 20 years.
Yeah.
Isn't it? No.
Oh, no, it's 2004.
15 years.
Yeah. And you're telling the story now.
Yeah.
So I was, curiosity that, you know, why telling the story now, like 15 years later? Why not, like at the time, maybe like 2 or 3 years after his release?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm getting old. I can still remember things. Huh? I wonder if I go much further, how much I can remember. Fortunately, I have lots of files, as my staff will tell you. So it helps me remember things. So the next story in the John Kam Remembers series will tell the story of my visit to Tilan Chao prison in Shanghai in the year 2000. So keep an eye out. Why am I doing this now? Because I want people to know that, in fact, such things are possible. You see? I was the head of a chamber of commerce and the vice president of an American multinational. That's what I did. I broke a mold. I did something I should not have done. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I did. And I'm proud of it. I did it. But you know, you look at this Sandy Fengillis case. Not a single... Here's a woman, a businesswoman, who has spent years promoting good U.S.-China relations, was the president of a big sister city association, was on the mayor of Dallas's International Trade Council. All of these things. Hmm? And she gets taken in and subjected to some very cruel treatment. She had 2 heart attacks when she was under detention, right? Not a single American organization. Not a single one. The Committee of 100. Hmm? Hmm? The National Committee for U.S.-China Relations. The U.S.-China Business Council. The Sister City Association. The American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing, in Hong Kong, in this country, not one of them said anything. Nothing. Nothing. It's shameful. All right? Now, if you can't speak out for her, who are you going to speak out for? Huh? Dun De Guangchun? Forget it. Huh? Li Heping? Huh? Forget it. You can't speak out for one of your own. Shame. Shame on you. Why am I telling these stories now? Because I want people to know that, in fact, it was possible. It is possible. It just takes a little bit of courage, courage and effort. That's all. That's why I'm doing it.
You mentioned your efforts, and I can relate to your saying that you're getting older. what are you doing in terms of a succession plan and in terms of people who will follow you to pick up your work?
Well, I have to tell you, I am blessed by having some really great colleagues, all of whom are much younger than me. And, you know, when I'm asked by some grantors, who is your successor? I say, I'm not worried about it. My successors are all around me, all right? And so I'm not looking outside. I expect to find a successor inside. And maybe I'll bring in some other people inside. But I tell you what, I am so honored that young people choose to work for me and this foundation. I'm really honored. That's my succession plan.
Okay. Thank you. I want to raise the case of Dr. Wang Bingzhang.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. He is definitely the most prominent political prisoners in China. He was probably among the first to get PhD after going abroad after 1976 when they opened the door for Chinese to come out. And then he turned a political dissident, freedom fighter for Chinese here, mostly in American land. I mean, he was a green card holder when he was kidnapped from Vietnam 15 years ago. He's almost, he's probably 70 years old now, and he's suffering from severe diseases. And he was sentenced to life in prison. Normally, you know, after 10 years, there will be some reduction. It will be committed to something else. But he's still under life in prison. So I think his case now is just one that every day I wake up, I think, oh, is there anything I can do for him? I mean, he's suffering.
Yes.
Just there, I mean, lonely, there by himself. I mean, he, if you know, anything happened, I think because he's like the benchmark. No, I think there is a message that the Chinese government is trying to send, you know, by basically just putting him in this condition. And of course, he is very strong. He's persistent in his political stance. He's not giving up. That's why he's treated so severely. It's very inhuman.
Yeah. I'll answer quickly because I know that our time is up. But look, I think I have put his name on my lists more than any other name on my list to the Chinese government at the provincial level and at the central level. I can't even estimate how many times I have put him on the list and how many times the response has come back, no change. Okay? But there will be a change. Now, you may know that about a year ago, a little more, he was moved to a better prison. Yes? Yes? Yeah. Well, how did that happen? How did that happen? How did he get from this bad situation to a better situation? How did that happen? It happened because of your work, my work, and everyone who cares about him. I always say this, you know, being released from prison early is a great thing, but if you're not being treated better in prison, you don't get to be released early. You die in prison. Jigme Sangpo, you know, you will leave here in a box. And I'm sure they've said the same thing. Not so fast. So don't lose hope.
Thank you.
Right?
There's a
Ming is a very similar situation. He actually died recently in prison.
Yeah, Peng Ming.
Yeah,
he's all right. Peng Ming, and how about Tenzin Delek Rinpoche? All right, you know, I mean, this guy is one of the holiest members of Tibetan Buddhism. He died in prison. All right, I was very involved in all that, trying to help the families get closure. So I tell you this, Wang Bingzhang has been moved to a better situation, just as Yang Maodong, Guo Feixiong, was moved into a better situation. It saved his life. He will live. He will live. You know, if you're not treated better in prison, you die in prison. That's all I can say at this point. Thank you again.
Thank you all for your outstanding questions and this dialogue here. And once again, I'd like to thank John Kam for his sixth appearance here at the Commonwealth Club, and we look forward to your seventh.
I hope you will invite me again.
I shall.
And thank you for a great turnout, you know. Thank you. Thank you.